Hello and welcome to episode 34 of Tabletop Game Talk, a show where we talk about tabletop games of all types. I'm one of your hosts, Josh.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Kitty.
Today we'll be talking about board games versus video games. What draws us to each? What does one type do better than the other? Why would we choose one over the other? That and more in this episode. But first, a thank you to our patron friends of the show, Emil Jim Jam, Jill Jam. That's the second time I've done that. I apologize, Emil. Shane Paul and George. If you're interested in supporting us on Patreon or in any other way, visit our webpage at tabletopgamehook.com and click the Support Us button in the upper right. All our Patreon levels include free auto entry into all our contests with bonus entries as well. Now let's go off topic with some news, announcements, and feedback.
Thanks, Josh. Welcome to the first-time listeners. Welcome back to the rest of you. This is our off-topic segment, and these are our announcements. Today, we have drawn the winner for our Fields of Green contest.
You've already done it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Josh was late, and we did it without him.
That's fine. Yep. That's fine.
It was all right. It was looked over by an accountant. AKA Sydney, and making sure that everything was accurately counted and gone through. So I know both of the winners right now.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm just going to sit here quietly, though, and tease it out a little bit.
Just holding that bombshell.
Yeah, just letting it go. So this particular contest was sponsored by Stronghold Games. Stephen Bonacore will be sending you a copy of Fields of Green personally. So I will get him your information. And we will also announce our next contest today, because we are to the point where we are constantly doing contests. In fact, I may even have another contest entry related.
That doesn't make any sense to me. You're just talking gibberish now. I don't understand.
I'm just trying to drag it out.
Chris
even more.
Got lost in his words.
All right. Without further ado, let's first announce the winner of our t-shirt, a Tabletop Game Talk t-shirt. If you want to know what these things look like, go to YouTube and take a look at us all dancing in front of the camera right now. If you're not a YouTube person and you just want to picture it in your head, well, just look at our podcast logo, take away the mics and put a black or blue background on there, and you essentially have our t-shirt.
I didn't realize we didn't have mics.
It looks better without the mics when you put it on t-shirt when I remove the background. Mm. So, yeah, it's more of a more casual thing.
Yeah, you're right. So, it does look,
yeah. I didn't even notice.
You know,
I didn't either.
This has been on all the swag that I've gotten in the last month, and it's good that you guys are paying attention.
So, I'm really good at this.
The winner of our t-shirt is Mike Smith.
Ta-da!
Congratulations!
Congratulations, Mike. Mike was auto-entered into the contest because he's a patron. And congratulations, Mike, you win. Our winner of Fields of Green is also a patron, but he also went in and entered and gave us a show topic. So we're going to do two things. One, we are going to use his show topic for the next episode, which you'll find out at the end of the episode. And we are going to have Stephen Bonacore of Stronghold Games send Fields of Green to Jason Strong.
Whoa.
Congratulations.
So congratulations, Jason. Thank you for your topic, which you will hear at the end of the episode. In brief, because I think you sent us a sentence and we're putting it down to basically 2 to 3 words. But it's your topic, I promise. Our next contest is going to be for a copy of Santorini plus its expansion, because I love this game quite a bit. And I think everyone should have it. It's a great gateway game. It's a great thinking game. It's a great gamer game. It just covers a lot of bases, and it's really fun to look at. So that's Santorini. The deadline will be 3 weeks from now. So this is going to be April 30th, midnight. That's a Friday. So you have 3 weeks to enter. And we will also be doing at once per month a random patron-only drawing, and that will be so I can give away more t-shirts and mugs and possibly messenger bags, and it'll be a tiered system. The first time you win, you'll get a t-shirt. Next time you win, you'll get a set of mugs. After that, I'll give you something really cool. So if you win multiple times, you get new stuff.
Chris mentioned the messenger bags, and I was like, where's my messenger bag?
I'm like, they haven't been made yet, but soon they will.
I'm excited about them.
All right. You should go and patron us. Just saying. No? Okay.
I patron you with my time.
That's what I was about to say.
Totally fair. If you're interested in becoming a patron, we really appreciate it. It helps me keep buying and giving away games and supporting all the network stuff and equipment. And eventually I'll break even. Probably not, but I'll spend less money out of my pocket over time. How's that? But you can visit us at tabletopgametalk.com/Patreon. And I've had this question come up, and I just want to be very clear. If you are a patron, you are automatically entered. There's nothing you need to do to enter any of our contests. If you want to enter, like Jason did, and fill in the question that that goes along with every contest, please do, because that question's interesting to me. I have not yet put up the form for Santorini as of this moment, but by the time you listen to this, you will, and then you'll know what the question is. So, moving right along to Kickstarter games. Guess what is now live on Kickstarter?
Gloomhaven.
That's a great guess.
I'm reading it off the notes. So
Gloomhaven is live. I think he funded his goal with like $300,000 in like 5 minutes, which is not surprising.
Right.
As of this recording, he's over 1.6 million. Wow. With almost, I think, 16,000-ish backers. I expect that to go up. He started out at 10 on the overall board game ranks. Now he's at 8. So that keeps climbing. Mark my words, it'll be number one by the end of the year, if not sooner. It's a fantastic game. It's $99 for the base game. That's all you have to spend if you don't have it, is the $99. Retail will be $140, and just go back it. Like, even if you don't like board games, go back it. Yeah. You can just put it on your shelf and be like, yeah, that's a 22-pound game that sits on my shelf. It's completely worth it.
I feel like that isn't good advice, but I mean... Maybe it is.
I mean, if you want to be like Chris.
Yeah. No, I'm serious. If there's any game you should own, this is the one. Like, it's, I don't know. I can't
for the right person. But I mean, I'm dying to play it. I mean, I still haven't played it.
Yeah, I was going to have you play it, but Josh was running a little late today.
I was. I have people in town, family members I have to host. So next time.
That's all right. I'm in, let's see, I think 10 games into my campaign with Sydney and Sarah, and we keep going strong every Wednesday. We play at least 2 games. Sydney and I actually played a game last night because our characters are a little bit behind experience in Sarah's. So we're like, let's do a random encounter, which has nothing to do with the campaign. But we played it for like 2 hours and we lost. And we're like, oh my God, we should play it again. That was so much fun. Like, wow. Losing is that much fun.
Wow.
I don't think we have yet to win. We were just trying to figure out the rules and we lost like 3 times in a row.
Yeah, usually within the first 1 or 2 turns. But
yeah, yep. It was...
It's fun, win or lose. Like,
it is.
The game is a blast.
Perfect.
It's another one of those games where you lose and then you're like, all right, I can do better next time.
Let's play again.
Yeah. Let's do it right now. Yeah. Right now. Set it up again. We can do this.
And there's really no penalty to losing, which is kind of the nice thing. Besides, you played part of the scenario and you'll need to play it again to unlock it. But you still get all the experience and gold that you got. You just don't get the bonus at the end and you don't get any unlockable. So you can try that scenario again and again and again until you beat it. Typically, you don't have to do it again and again, though. I mean, you'll get the first 1 or 2 are a little bit hard, but once you get that first level or that first perk, it becomes way more, you have a lot more options and more fun.
Also, cool. If you're playing by the correct rules with the right number of monsters.
Yeah, if you heal yourself and don't set up a 3-player game for a 2-player game.
Like you guys did.
Yeah.
We made a big mess that first time, but we learned from our mistakes.
We did. A couple other Kickstarters I want to bring to people's attention. Arcanus. This is a role-playing setting that started out back in the D&D 3 era. And then when D&D 4 came around, they made their own version. So it was the Arcanus role-playing game. And now they're doing a 5e version of it. So this setting's been around for over a decade. And it's a really cool setting. I've played the game with the people who make the setting. For $25, you can get the PDF. So if you're into D&D 5e at all, this is a cool setting. You're going to get more classes, more perks, more races, a new world. It's worth taking a look at. If you are not into D&D, maybe this is where you break into it. And Gaddis Gaming, they sent me an email calling my attention to a World War I skirmish game that they are kickstarting called Shattered Crown. World War I games aren't necessarily my thing, but that might not be for everybody. So I wanted to bring everyone's attention to it. It's a World War I miniatures game. And when you look at the figures for it, it looks like the classic green army men. So it's kind of a cool little kickback, but it's a tabletop basically two-player skirmish game. And the two-player starter set starts at 88, but that includes a lot of figures and the rules, obviously, and all of that. So if World War One or war games in general are something that you're into, or skirmish games, check that out. That's Shattered Crown on Kickstarter.
I feel like you don't see as many World War One games.
There's so many World War II. Yep.
Not a lot of World War
Smart move. Yeah.
Yep. I wonder if there's trenches. I'm going to have to look.
They have at least a couple things, and it looks like there might be trenches.
And I feel like the Germans had those cool pointy hats in World War One.
They did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to look at the German figures.
Their helmets are
Pointy. Yeah. Yes, yeah. The pointy, like, so they can duck their head down and run into you.
I imagine that was what it's for. Yeah. It was like another knife.
It's like a head bayonet.
Yeah. Sweet. I think that makes total sense.
Smart move.
All right.
War historians everywhere are shaking their heads at us.
We talk about, we're a board gaming podcast, not a historical podcast.
Oh, Hugo Boss as well. They did the design for the Nazi uniforms, but I want to say that might have been World War II.
That might be World War II.
Another little tidbit that's probably wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. The British.
All right. Let's go to some feedback about our past episodes. And if you have any feedback about this or any of our previous episodes, email us at tabletopgametalk@gmail.com and become part of the conversation.
So before Josh does this, I just, for those who are watching on YouTube, and I know there's a few people, Kitty is not texting or surfing the web on her phone.
Yeah.
So we use Google Docs for our show notes.
Show notes.
And Josh and I have iPads in front of us, and Kitty's just always looking at her phone. It's because she's looking at the show notes.
Like 90% of the time. 90%
there might
be the odd text here or there.
Sometimes she's texting her sister.
Or watching Disney movies.
Or watching Disney movies. If we
get too boring for her, you know.
Really into Moana right now.
Yeah. So, all right, back to...
So, yes, we have Michael on Board Game Geek, our last episode. He says, the biggest feature I don't remember hearing about that I use and forgot to mention on the first go-around is recording my plays. I use this as a gauge to test how likely I am to keep a game in my collection. I have quite a small living space and can only devote so much space to the game shelves. By recording how many times I play the game, which I only started doing recently with any frequency, I can see if this is something I keep coming back to or my family likes, as well as my gaming group.
Yeah. And we did briefly mention it. Josh was like, why would you ever do that?
Yeah.
Which is, this is why you would do that.
Yeah, good response, kind of see. Michael. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. Because Michael, he doesn't have the same... Well, I'm assuming he hasn't turned his dining room into a game room, such as I have done. And it makes sense to say, well, I haven't played... you know, whatever, Conquest of Narath, which is a literal game I'm looking at. Yeah. I have not played that game in 4.5-5 years. I know this for sure because I remember the last time I played it. And maybe that's a good sign to sort all my games by the number of plays in recent, and then I will know what to trade, which is the other part he goes into, talking about the trade mechanism. So apparently you go to propose a trade. There's a whole trade interface. You do pick someone who has something for trade that you want, and you kind of match up.
Right.
And then the trade disputes there, like if you were going to set up like shipping costs, who's going to, you know, pay for what. But if there's any issues, you try to work it out amongst yourselves. And that's what the trade dispute is for, is if you can't work it out amongst yourselves. So I might look into this, you know, a few games like Conquest of Narath, that if you were interested in trading Conquest of Narath for anything, let me know. Actually, it's a really good game. I might want to actually play it again. See, this is
why you're a hoarder.
All right. Anyway, Kitty, go to the next one.
Okay, from Christy. On our Board Game Geek episode, a tip for subscribing to forums of a game, general gaming, or whatever, you can limit your subscription to only new threads. So if it's overwhelming to get every comment on every thread once you've subscribed to the forum, you can click the little triangle, go to edit subscription, and change reply to no.
Yeah, this is a good tip for me because I've just started subscribing to things. So I'll click on a game and I'll just click subscribe to the game. So every image, every forum, every everything, it'll give me like a notification. So I spend a lot of the time just marking as red because you can just go to the right and click mark red, mark red, mark red. But I could probably just say, yeah, I don't want the replies unless I subscribe to a particular thread, because you can do that as well. So you can turn off the general replies but still subscribe to the thread and have that work. Josh's eyes are like, Board Game Geek is really complicated.
That's exactly what I was thinking. I was just I mean, it kind of is going to segue nicely into the on-topic thing. It can, I think there's a certain barrier to entry with some of these things, but we can talk about it when we do the board games versus video games.
Fair enough. All right.
All right, so let's go to a question from one of our listeners. This is a question that won't fill an entire show topic, but that we think is interesting nonetheless. Today's question comes from Jose Luis, and he asks, what is the ideal ratio between price / games played? Is price a deal breaker for you when buying a game?
So I think this is an interesting question. And actually, while Josh wasn't here, Kitty and I were talking about whether or not we would make this a complete show topic or not.
Right.
And we figured we can throw it here because we'll bring up price a little bit in board games versus video games. And it's kind of a overarching topic. So we wanted to cover it a little bit. One of the things that Jose Luis kind of pointed out was in other countries. So he's from Mexico, and in other countries, the price of board games is much, much higher, especially when you look at the wages of an average person. So, you know, where minimum wage here, I don't even know what minimum wage is, but it's in, you know, $15, I think, in California. That's the one I've heard most recently.
$15
an hour is like the dream of minimum wage in America.
It's not yet. They're pushing through legislation to try and do it in some places, but it won't be until like 2020 or something.
All right. Well, if it's going to happen, it'll happen in California first.
Yeah, probably.
So, but in any case, whatever it is, I'm sorry, I haven't...
Chris is out of touch with the common man.
So yeah, what we're saying is... prices of games are really expensive. When I was in Brazil and I was looking, and a game where I would typically buy here for maybe $60 or $70, it was over $100 US in Brazil. And that's a place where typically you expect they make less average salary than you make here. So proportionally speaking, games are really expensive. So I think this is a pretty topical question. I'm going to let you guys answer it, though, because apparently I'm out of touch with the common man.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think part of the problem is that you're making a physical thing with physical components most of the time when you're doing board games. And that's a lot of the cost baked into it. You know, you're having to design this one thing and then create all these little miniatures and the boards and the design. Whereas, you know, the amount of copies that you're going to sell is not very high. It's still a very niche market. Yeah.
But what would you... So if you're going to drop $75 on a game,
right,
what do you need to be in that box to justify that $75?
For me, it needs to be something I'm going to play again and again and again. Yeah, which is different for everyone. Like for me, it will probably be more like party games, which I don't think there are too many party games that are $75. But it would have to be a more gateway-y game that I could bring out more often with people who aren't into as hardcore games, so that I could get it to the table more often.
Yeah.
Also, I think maybe if you have a gaming group that you want to play more of these higher price range games, maybe pool in together, because you are not going to play as many times if you are not interested in... Like, you don't have a game group to play with. Sorry, I got totally distracted.
So, basically, what that gets to is, say, for example, Gloomhaven.
Yeah.
If I spend $100 on Gloomhaven, that's a lot of money for one person to spend.
Yep.
But if I know that my gaming group has four people and we're all going to be playing Gloomhaven together, then it's only $25 a piece. I think that's what Kitty was trying to say.
That's what I was trying to say.
Before she realized her phone was on the cord and making the... static go fuzz fuzz fuzz.
But then, but those kind of legacy games, you know, like Gloomhaven is a type of game that has this kind of legacy, this new legacy style, which I want to say has only been around for a very short time, right?
Well, and technically speaking, people will argue whether or not Gloomhaven is legacy or not.
Right.
I think it's as close to legacy as you can get without being one of the three actual legacy games.
Right.
But let's say campaign style.
Right. Yeah. That's what I mean. And that's, you know, your bang for your buck then, if you're then splitting it amongst the group and you know you're going to be able to, you are going to get this to the table again and again and again, then, you know, you've got to look at it as like the amount of money spent versus the hours that you've actually enjoyed with it. You know, we played 20 games or whatever. 19 of Pandemic Legacy. How many hours of enjoyment was that? We loved every single time we played. You know, if you split that down, it's going to be like cents per hour.
Well, if you look at it, like I bought it for $50. It was basically probably less than that. It was probably $45 off of Amazon. We played it for at least 20 hours just to keep the math simple.
Yeah.
So let's say $40, $20 is $2 a play for the four of us, which is 50 cents an hour.
Yeah.
to play a game that we had an amazing time with and a game that people complained that, well, you can only play it once through and then you're done. Sure, but at 50 cents an hour, I'm still better off than any other game that I own right now.
Yep.
So that makes a big difference, is your idea of, or your point of, how often do I get it to the table?
Yeah.
Price per play. And then can you split that amongst your game group? You know,
yeah.
Does it make sense to do that? Who owns the game type of thing?
If there's four of you, you each go out and buy a different game, and then you have four games to play together instead of just one.
Actually, I even like that idea better, because if everyone owns a piece of Gloomhaven, who gets to keep it?
Yeah. Right.
But if I'm like, all right, well, I will spend $100 on this, and I have three other people I play games with, well, you spend $100 on this game we're interested in, and then you can kind of like, well, this is my game, this is, we'll play it together type of thing. I was just looking at Zaya on Amazon the other day, which is about $83, I think. And I play this with Kitty and Josh and Reed, and they own the game. And I'm like, I really like this game, and I want to own it. I want to buy it because it's a game I like. But I didn't. I'm like, no, the people I play it with, they already own it. I'm trying to get better at this.
Wow. You are almost reforming. You're turning over a new leaf. This is great.
It's making me shake a little bit, though.
Yeah, I really want to play this game.
Withdrawal symptoms. You look uncomfortable.
Yeah. When the expansion comes out and they have the solo campaign mode in there, I'm probably going to end up getting it. So, any other thoughts on prices of games? Let me talk deal breaker. Anyone have a deal breaker on price? Because I have a couple.
Oh, go for it.
No, I want to hear yours.
So card games, if it's a deck of cards, and or even like up to maybe 100, 120 cards, if it's anything more than $20, I'm probably not going to buy it.
Gotcha.
Like, it's just, I understand the amount of time and testing and art especially that go behind a card game like that. But for some reason, I just, the value for how much money I'm putting down for it isn't there. I just don't feel it there. So I'm probably not going to do it. If it's over, like $50 is where I look at a game being, where I start thinking it's a premium game. And so if it's $50, I want to make sure that the components are nice, that I'm going to, it's a good tactile feel, the art is good. And if I look at something, and even if the game is great, I don't know that right away. So it has to look good for me to hit that $50 mark. At $100, I am almost never going to buy it in the store. I'm just going to look at this big box. It's going to be like $100 to $130 or whatever. I'm in a game store and I feel terrible about it, but I'm just like, I know I can get this like 40% off if I buy it online.
Right.
I'll drop $50, no problem, knowing that I'm going to spend an extra $10. But when I'm talking $40 or $50, I'm like, all right, I have to go online for this one because I can buy a whole nother game with what I save.
Makes sense.
So those are some breaking points for me when I'm taking a look at things. I am attracted to small box games, though. If I'm looking at a game where it's, you know, like a tiny epic fill in the blank game, that one, dropping $25 on it, I won't even think twice because there's so many cool things in there, and what they can pack into such a small box just impresses me by itself. But
you can also look into game trades and buying used games.
Yeah.
You have to, you know, be careful you're not buying something that's missing pieces, doesn't have the rule book in there, but it might be worth it.
Yeah.
Someone you know, especially, is getting rid of a game. Yep. You know, pick those up.
Yep. And a lot of game stores now will have consignment sections. So Cat and Mouse Game Stores here in Chicago, they have an entire consignment section now where you can just say, hey, I want to sell this game. You put a price on there, they'll put it on the shelf. I think there's like 30 days or something. If it doesn't sell, they'll give you a call and say, hey, this isn't going to sell. But, you know, so you can get a lot of cheap games that way. Burke's Gambit. Josh and I played a lot this weekend.
So good.
It's such a small little game. I don't remember the cost, but it can't be more than like $20, $25. Best $25 I've spent.
Social deduction game, and it's overtaken all other social deduction games at the moment.
Yeah, I enjoy Burke's Gambit far more than Resistance or Avalon or Werewolf. And I mean, these are staple games for me.
Yeah, those are great games, but you're right. This game was better of that, but it's of that ilk. It's that social deduction type thing.
It has a little bit more social deduction than, you know, your typical mechanics game, but it has a lot more mechanics. So even if you figure out who the bad guy is, you still have to mechanically get rid of them. So it's kind of like a Battlestar Light type of thing.
You're right. Yeah, it's a bit like that.
Yeah. Check it out. It is really, really, really good. If you like any kind of social deduction, if you've ever liked playing The Resistance, I'm not saying everyone's going to say this is better than Resistance, but for me, I
well, yeah, you've got two here, so
yeah. All right, let's move on, shall we?
In this episode, we're talking about board games versus video games. It's fair to say that video games are far more mainstream, but board games are on the rise. What are the fundamental differences, and when do we prefer one over the other?
Yeah, so first I want to say something that just came to the top of my head, because we don't edit the show. It's right. Just a total stream. But when I'm listening back to it, it sounds like I do quick edits, like I cut something out.
That one was like a perfect something that sounded like an edit, yeah.
Yeah, and it wasn't. It was just all of a sudden me like, oh, and we should go on to this next thing now. And just like, boom, switching over. But
you're a natural at radio, Chris. Brilliant.
All I know is there's a video of it. We could prove that we didn't edit it. Except for... No, that we won't get into that. Now everyone was going to ask. Last week, there were some sirens. We paused the audio and I had to slightly cut fix the video. I didn't fix video, though. I left that whole clip in there, by the way. Okay. So if you want to see the 20 seconds that we were paused for the siren going by, go to YouTube. Anyway, what are we talking about today, Josh?
Board games versus video games.
All right.
You know, it's I mean, like you said, it is more mainstream video games, but there are certain things that board games can do better than video games. You know, I think one of them being, and we started to talk about it already, is the social interaction thing. I mean, we all know that you can play multiplayer video games and you can play online with your friends, but there's something to be said for sitting in the same room around the same table and facing each other and kind of interacting with each other whilst you play a game together. I think it's been said that, you know, most communication is nonverbal. So being sat in that same room as each other and kind of having to interact in a much more direct way with some board games, you know, like with social deduction games, like there is a certain charisma and kind of interaction that's going on that you just can't get from multiplayer video games.
Yep. I think. Yeah. Well, I think Michael, actually, that you bring it in perfectly. So I'm going to read Michael's an excerpt from one of something he posted on Board Game Geek. Board games, on the other hand, so this is at the end of the thing, offer a great social experience with far less chance of running into a jerk. Most people are less likely to be terrible to someone who they actually have to sit across the table from. The communities that form here and are more supportive for the most part, and the games offer a way to interact face-to-face. I find that it is easier to engage with someone across the board game as well, since they are most likely not distracted by anything but the game. This isn't to say that the board games are superior for socialization or socializing. I spent several years as competitive Magic the Gathering player, and the community there can be just as hard to handle as the ones I mentioned in the video games. It's very true. But I think that's a really good point, is... when you're sitting across the table and you just have to stare someone in the eye, you're not going to be a jerk. You're not going to be just cussing at them, you know, the 13-year-old kids on Xbox Live.
Right.
You know, just stereotype. Cursing,
yeah, each other because they think it's funny and they've got that anonymity.
Yeah.
I like to play multiplayer video games in person.
Yeah.
Get four people, four controllers, playing old school.
That's good.
That's really fun. I cannot think. One of my favorite video games ever is GoldenEye.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
For the Nintendo 64.
Yeah.
Yep.
You get four people playing, and then you do like the weird multiplayer, like slap only, and you running around all the places, and you start to learn all the like weird spawn points. Yeah. They're going to be in the toilet. And like,
this
running
is
around. Yeah.
Back in the day when there were four screens on one TV and you all had to look at your own screens.
Yeah. Yep. I think that's a way more fun way to play a multiplayer video game than doing Xbox Live. I am not a fan.
And like also personally, there's all those kind of wee kind of social party games that you got, you know, like the karaoke ones and the dance ones and the sporting ones. So they do, like you say, have that element where you kind of, I remember as a teenager playing with my friends and my brothers like until like 4 a.m. with these multiplayer games, you know, like Power Stone for the Dreamcast was amazing for that. And it was just, you do still have that interaction. I think where board games or a certain type of board games, like social deduction games, I feel kick it up one more level from that, because whilst you're still having fun in a multiplayer game, social deductions, and actually the guy from I think it's called Shut Up and Sit Down.
Shut Up and Sit Down, yeah.
He's a very well-known reviewer. He had an article about this, and he puts it... I'm going to read it because it was really good. But he's talking about, like, the... That's it. Video games cannot yet challenge our personal charisma, leadership, and duplicity. They can't challenge us socially. And he says, hell, they've barely scratched the surface of bluffing. So it's a good point, because it's like, when you're playing a social deduction game, the game is between each other. You know,
well, it doesn't even have to be a social deduction. Any board game that's competitive
that has that element, right? Yep. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, it's like, it's, you know, some of the moments when we were playing Burke's Gambit was because we were just amazed at someone's ability to lie to us. And I can't think of any video game where you're lying to the other people, as that's like a core mechanic of the game. And we were just like in awe of Andre, my nephew-in-law. He was just amazing. He's like 11 and he was just amazing at lying, and he just kept like tricking us left, right, and center. We're like, how are you? See, you're so natural at this. Yes. Like, as a group, it was this interesting like dynamic. You know, we were like this little tribe playing this game and kind of all feeding off each other.
He's 11, right?
Yeah, he's 11. Yeah.
Yep. So 11-year-old boy, very, very quiet, but so manipulative in this game. Like, he knew exactly what he was doing every step of the way. And Sylvia was also playing with us as well, and she was just so passionate. Because there was a game where she was innocent, and, you know, I was not. I was team red, she was team blue, but I had to like throw her under the bus, and she was just like passionately like, no, this is the stupidest thing ever. I'm definitely good. How could anyone think I'm not?
She was,
I'm
like screaming practically.
Sounds like something I would do, which is why I'm not a big fan of social deduction games, because when I'm innocent, I'm like, I am passionately innocent, throwing everything out on the table. And when I'm guilty, I'm like, I just look real guilty right now, guys.
But that's not something you can get from video games right now.
No.
It's kind of like everyone has an avatar poker face.
Yeah.
But it's not something you get from even most board games, I'd say. A level of social interaction in every single board game, because you see each other face to face. But most games, there isn't any mechanic that relies on that.
Yeah.
Some really do, and those just cannot be replaced by video games.
Well, think of it like, let's go to Settlers of Catan. Mm-hmm. I've played this game dozens and dozens of times on the iPad. In person, I've probably played it maybe a dozen, possibly two dozen times. There's a huge difference. Number one, on the iPad, I can play it very quickly. And we're not talking video games of board games typically, but I just kind of apples to apples this. When I'm playing Catan in person, I can manipulate where you're going to build that road by having interaction with you saying, it wouldn't make sense to block me here.
Are you going to put it there?
Yeah. It's like, you know, you could probably go over there.
That's a choice.
When I'm playing a video game, I don't have that same ability to socially interact with the moment to affect how you take your turn. Now, maybe the video version is more pure because nobody's messing with you, but I would say the in-person one is more fun and interactive because you get to have that conversation.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a little metagamey, but yeah.
Yeah, this is the point. If Spencer was here, he would point out how much of a horrible person you are, and that's why you love that type of mechanic, because you want to manipulate.
Spencer's little brick for brick thing.
Also.
We got a response from one of our listeners against the rules.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Breaking the rules, Spencer.
Yeah, so not only was he being a jerk in person, he was not following the rules at the same time.
It's true.
Yeah. I quite like it. So if you're wondering what we're talking about, you're going to have to go back to, I don't know, the late teens, I think.
You got to tell them. So basically, Spencer would be, you know, do this whole trade, like, you're going to give me a sheep and I'll give you a brick, and it was like, you know, all this intuitive crazy stuff, and then he'd just give them the same resource. So if it was a brick that he was trying to get off them, he'd just be giving them a brick.
Him do it in person, and it is very irritating, and he does it in a way that you never think he's doing it until you look at your card and you're just like,
not again.
So let's just say there are trolls in life at board games as well.
Right. It can happen.
So Spencer's, which he's actually upstairs playing, what, a 4X game right now, you said?
He was. That was one of the text messages I actually got, as he just went on a motorcycle ride. But he was playing Galactic Civilization.
I love that game.
Of course you do.
Yeah, Masters of Orion 2, one of the best games ever made. This was back in the 90s. Galactic Civilization is kind of the spiritual successor of it. It's so good. But you can also play Masters of Orion on the iPad, which is also the same thing on the iPad version. But now we're talking about video. And honestly, this topic is not meant to say board games are better than video games.
Right.
Really what we're kind of evaluating is...
Because I actually think in this situation, Galactic Civilization is so much easier for a 4X style game than any board game version is. Maybe not better, but simpler, yeah. Easier
You're
to play.
You're talking about like some online version of
Well,
it,
let's say Zaya.
Game
so,
of it.
So Zaya is essentially a 4X space game.
Right.
And Galactic Civilization is a 4X space game.
Right.
So on a video game, you are playing against computer players, or you can play an online version, or you play against other players online. Spencer just plays against bots. And he plays this over and over again. But you don't have to set up any tiles, boards. You don't have to have plastic spaceships. You don't have to have resource cubes. You don't have to have money. You don't have to spend 6 hours playing it start to finish, because if the table gets bumped, it's ruined. You can save your game, come back 3 hours later, go out, get dinner, go to the bathroom without the cat jumping on the table.
Stay up till 4 o'clock in the morning, taking just one more turn.
Yep.
But yeah, this is totally the convenience argument for video games. Yeah. It's you know, like you say, I mean, even just getting everyone in the same room can be difficult, right? So that way, you know, if it's all virtual, we can do it all from the comforts of our own home and, you know, have different schedules. And it is slightly easier that way on multiple levels.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the fundamental differences between a board game and a video game. With a board game, somebody needs to know how this game plays.
Yeah.
And they need to run the game for all the between turn stuff and making sure people are following their turn. Eventually, everyone who's playing it will know those rules and maybe everyone will be on the same playing field. But for something, I'll bring Gloomhaven up as an example. In that game, I am running all of the pieces. I'm running all the AI for the monsters. I'm essentially doing everything that a single player wouldn't do for themselves. Plus, I'm playing myself as well.
Yep.
So if I'm not there to have someone else try to set this game up who hasn't done what I'm doing, they have to learn all of that.
Yeah.
When you have a video game, it does all that for you.
Yeah.
And then you don't have to, you know, no one has to worry about it. And a lot of Sentinels of the Multiverse is another game. It's a cooperative game. Everyone has a deck of cards that represent a superhero that they're playing. And they're playing against the board and they're playing against a villain deck. Well, at the end of every round, the villain does something and somebody has to manage the villain. When you play it on the iPad, the villain is managed for you. All you have to worry about is playing your character. Just because you know how to play it on the iPad does not mean you could set that game up and run it.
Yeah, it's
you don't,
true.
Yeah, because you don't know all the rules. You don't know all the other stuff that happens.
Same for Pandemic.
Yep.
Lots of other games.
Yep. Yeah, it's just that. That's what I said before we started the segment. You know, it made me think when you were talking about the board game geek stuff and you said, oh, I can see that Josh finds that complicated. It is a big barrier to entry. You know, that some of these rule books are like more than 10 pages and it's complicated and there's jargon in there. There's lots of terminology that are very specific to each game. So it's a real like mind bending thing to kind of have to get all this knowledge and then, like you say, teach other people. Okay. Whereas with video games, a lot of them are so easy, so intuitive that like even a very small child could pick up and start doing stuff.
Yeah. Or they have a tutorial. You learn as you go. It teaches you how to play.
Yeah.
So, oh, we're going to, you know, go on our first mission. Here's how you shoot your gun. Here's how you, you know, interact with the ship. Like it step by step. And then you can like, you know, skip tutorial. That's all I feel like you ever do.
But get me in there and then I'll just smash buttons and figure it out. Because the game's not going to let me do it wrong.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah, you know, you talk about a 10-page manual. Until you get to 32 pages, I don't even think it's an instruction manual.
Speaking of mashing buttons and games where everyone's in the same room playing, Super Smash Brothers is so much fun.
Right.
All of its incarnations. But seriously, that's how I play every single time. It's just,
smash the buttons.
Hit the buttons. Yeah. I'm doing things.
Any fighting game, I'm like that, yeah.
I only play Kirby because I like to float.
Yep.
Pretty cute character.
And I think, it makes sense why a video game's the barrier to entry is so much smaller. Also, visually. Yeah. Like, it's fun to look at.
Yeah. It's juicy feedback that you don't get in board games. Like, in the Candy Crush, you know, your first level or whatever, it teaches you exactly which thing to swipe. There's no way you can lose. And then immediately, you know, there's coins flying out from everywhere, like, bah, 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 like noises and stuff. Like, you, that's what they call in the industry juicy feedback. And you get so much of that from video games, whether it be more story, more, you know, rewards and all this music razzmatazz. Whereas you're not going to get that in a board game that often.
Yeah.
You can also get story feedback. A lot of first person player games, you are going through a story start to finish. It has a story arc and you unlock cutscenes and you get to watch what happens. Your actions seem to move the story forward.
Mm.
This can also feel a little bit like you're railroaded. Your choices don't actually make a difference. You always get to the same cutscene. You have to do the same action to unlock it.
But they do a good job of giving you the illusion that you had some, you know, like in any RPG that I've played as a video game, like let's say the Final Fantasy series, like I felt like I was pushing the story on, even though it was
going,
you know, a railway. Yeah, like you say, it felt like I was exploring this world and making things happen. And it's so cinematic, you know, I feel really immersed in these games because not only do I feel like that main character is my avatar and I am that character, but, you know, you turn the lights out and you hear the music and you hear the sounds of the enemies and stuff. It's all there and you feel like you're in the game. I mean, which game was it? The one with the zombies. What's it called again? Which video
Fallout?
Game? The video game that's like really well known for the zombies. I can't believe I've forgotten it.
Well, while you're thinking that, I'm going to read something from Steve.
Resident Evil.
Resident Evil,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and that game is, again, great. Turn out the lights and you are afraid. You are really, really afraid. And I don't think I've ever been afraid playing a board game unless I'm like the werewolf.
Well, you can be on the edge of your seat playing a board game, but you're probably not afraid.
You do not. So my dad is a huge fan of the Resident Evil games. My dad plays video games. He doesn't play board games very often, but video games all the time. And he's played through those so many times. I remember catching him sleeping with the light on because he was like, I played too much Resident Evil at night.
Oh, I've done that before. Definitely.
So I do want to get this input from Steve. I feel like video games are just one step above watching TV. Now, that's a
bold statement.
A bold statement. Steve. But let's go on and see what he justifies here. You are engaged a little more, but usually now games are just grinding along, watching a story unfold instead of shaping what is happening like in a board game. That is why I love board games. Games like Sherlock Holmes, Consulting Detective, Jack the Ripper, and the West End Adventures keeps me mentally active, and playing games like Through the Ages, A New Story, or Civilization encourages me to go out and learn something new. So that kind of gets back to this. Now, I will say that most board games, you're eventually going to get to the end too, but the journey of how you get to the end feels different in some way than a video game. It feels like you had a lot more choices in getting there, where with a video game, I just have to get good enough so I can get past this part.
Right.
Now, that's not true for all video games. There's just as many different types of video games as there are anything else. But when you're talking those linear storylines, oftentimes it is get good enough to get past this part to get to the next part. And a board game doesn't typically have that kind of feeling to it.
My biggest irritation in video games like that is not you have to get good enough to get past it. It's you have to go and talk to the right person. You have to go and find the right item.
Right.
And if it's not clear from the beginning, this is what happened to me playing Final Fantasy is I think I was playing Final Fantasy IV.
Right.
Is that the one with the train station? Or is that 7?
Oh, that's 7, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So I was playing Final Fantasy VII. I've tried playing both, so it's a little confusing.
Right.
I got stuck in the train station, and like I couldn't figure out who I was supposed to talk to, what I was supposed to get, and I was just like, I'm done. And I turned it off and walked away and didn't go back for years.
Well, there's the other extreme too, though. So all your modern MMOs, massive multiplayer online games, I was actually asked just the other day, what does MMO stand for? They have exclamation points over everyone's head that you should talk to.
Right.
You know, it's actually a question mark if you should talk to them to get a quest, an exclamation mark if you go there to complete it. So now you don't even have to think about it anymore. You just find your question marks and find your exclamation points and click on that person. So you don't actually need to read the story at all.
I think you do lose a little bit of the flavor, though.
Oh, you definitely do.
Talking to you, the random villagers trying to find the right random villager.
But that's the thing, though. With a video game, you kind of have to find that balance of not enough help or too much help, or should we guide you through the whole thing or not guide you through it? Should we put you on the rails, not put you on the rails?
Yeah.
Or maybe we just make another clone of Candy Crush. So that's
very lucrative type of game.
So that's what we're doing as video games designers. And for those who don't know, I did video game design for almost 15 years, from AAA titles down to kids games and plug into play stuff. And that was always something that we thought about when making a game. I made touchscreen arcade games, and you know, where you literally were putting quarters in the machine. And our goal was to make sure you won the game 70% of the time. That was the magic number.
Right.
At that point, you will keep playing. So when you lose that 30% of the time, you're like, okay, I'm going to do it again.
Yep.
But it was hard enough where you wanted to play again and get a better score. Like, right. It's a formula. With a board game, I don't know that there is as strict of formulas. Because you have all these independent designers making, you know, 2,000 to 5,000 copies of a game, they can go out and take risks. That's not to say there's not tons and tons of clones and this game isn't just like that game. But it feels like you can do a lot more with a board game, that you don't have to just be true to that video game, because you don't have to sell a million copies to break even.
It's innovation. I mean, this touches really nicely on another thing that the Sharp and Sit Down reviewer guy was talking about, which was that really, when you get a board game, most often you're getting someone's creation, literally one designer's idea and dream of a game and what it could be. And there is that control from the creator where, no, this is exactly how the game is going to be. You've worked in the video game industry. You know how many people and how many sort of decision makers, you know, how many, well, we've got to play to this market, that market, or the other. You really do lose that control of that entire artistic vision of what a game could be, unless you're a real indie person making a game completely from scratch on your own with a lot less budget. But with these games, often it's a really unique, and there's so much innovation. You know, like Santorini, I hadn't played a game like that before. It's like a real new spin on this tic-tac-toe idea, but with so much depth with the different types of characters. You know, there is real like innovation with like legacy and stuff coming up.
Well, Santorini is an interesting one, because that game has existed for, I want to say, almost a decade and a half.
Oh, wow.
But not published. There was a professor who basically made this game as a classroom training tool.
Oh.
And then it just became something that grew over time, and someone said, hey, we should publish this. So
that's crazy.
So you never know how these board games make it out there. It's also easier to make a board game than a video game. It's not easy to make a board game, but it's easier. A video game requires, at this point, if you're going to do a AAA title, even if you're doing a mobile version.
Millions, surely.
Yeah. I mean, you're looking at least $1 million.
Yeah.
You're looking at the last AAA title I worked on, there was 38 people working on it. About 12 of them were developers. We had designers, we had artists, and that was just in the production staff, not counting marketing, not counting all the other stuff that goes around, you know, packaging and putting the game out there. So it's really, really expensive, and you have to make a game that's going to appeal to the masses. With a board game, I can just make the board game. It's going to sell to the people that want to buy it. And with Kickstarter, I know exactly how many people are willing to pay up front for it.
Yeah.
So I can put out games that are just kind of games of passion versus a marketing tool.
Yeah, and you can just break out the sort of pens and papers and, you know, just put your idea, you know, a rough draft of your idea into reality in one day, and then be playtesting it almost that afternoon or evening or something.
Yep. Now, I do want to talk about cost a little bit.
Right.
So we talked, that was our question of the day, but or a quick question. But I was looking, I actually stopped at a GameStop earlier today. I was on my normal walk, I'm like, I'm going to take a look. The cost of a board game versus a video game, I'm going to say that on average, board games are more expensive. You get more physical pieces in them, so part of that is the reason why they're more expensive. But the resale market in video games is so easily just cycled through that you can buy used games that would retail for $80. Buy them for $20.
Yes.
Yeah. So, And it's the exact same thing. You're not worried about the pieces being used or the cards being folded or fingerprints all over, whatever.
Yeah.
You're just putting the disc in the machine and it works.
You do have to worry about scratched discs or fingerprints. My sister's a big fan of getting kids movies from the library for my niece. And she says, like, you get just the absolute grossest DVDs. They're covered in sticky grossness.
But normally,
they
like,
wash them.
Yeah. If you get That's a used right. game, though, and it doesn't work, you bring it back and they give you their new version or give you your money back.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, so it is a little bit cheaper if you're dealing with secondhand markets for video games. Board games, though, you can also deal with that secondhand market and get games much cheaper. They're just harder to find.
Yeah. I mean, you're still talking about the same ballpark, I would say. That's the good thing, yes. is that roughly, you know, probably like, you know, somewhere, anywhere, really, you can find card games for like $10 or whatever. And then it runs all the way up to like 100 plus. But, you know, the midpoint, what would you say, like sort of $40 or...
For a board game?
Yeah, 40 to 60
The average board game these days for a box of like a Fields of Green size, which is kind of a standard size box, is going to run you between anywhere between $55 and $75 retail.
Yeah.
You're probably going to get about a 30% discount if they sell it through Amazon. Yeah. Not everybody does. Pyramid Arcade, a game I love, you don't find that on Amazon. You can only buy that directly through Looney Labs.
Right.
So you're paying their retail price if you're going to buy it through them. And you're not going to buy Pyramid Arcade as a discount. Like, you're not going to see that used very often.
Right.
So you're on average, yeah, you're going to probably pay a little bit more if you're buying... Well, you're going to pay the same if you're buying new. Mm. You're probably going to pay a little bit more if you're going to try to discount or aftermarket route. But don't think of it as how much does Pyramid Arcade cost. So Pyramid Arcade is $77. Think about it. How much hours am I going to play it? What's the price per hour of this game?
Yeah.
If I buy Madden... I don't actually know if they still make Madden. I'm assuming they do. And I play that for a season, and I play, you know, 16 games with my particular team. Maybe I play it for 16 hours and then I'm bored with it. Okay. So that costs me, that was like a $70 game. Cost me, you know, what, $4 an hour, somewhere five, four or $5 an hour. Okay, fine. Pyramid Arcade, if I play that for 77 hours, because it's an unlimited number of games, that was $1 an hour.
Yeah.
I think Madden might not be the best choice for that, though, because you look
That's
at something
one
like
that you play a lot,
Skyrim.
Yeah. Yes.
Skyrim. Spencer has played, I can't even count how many hours.
It's probably 100 plus or something.
Easily.
Yeah.
Skyrim. I know the Fallout games get a lot of replay. My dad will play every game he owns three times. He plays through once on the regular level, he plays through a second time on the regular level, and then he plays through on the expert level. They've always got like these mercenary level, like the highest.
Wow, he's got like
difficulty.
A system for playing these video games. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's like
never heard
his hobby. That's what he does.
That's
and
great.
He's very kind of particular about the games he'll play, but it's always if he likes the first playthrough, he wants to do the three playthroughs at least.
Well, I used to do that when I played. I mean, like I said, I used to be addicted to video games in the same way board games now. I might need to see someone about that. But anyway, I used to play. I'd play through and say, okay, now I've beat it. Now I want to go through and hit everything I missed on the first play. Because I'd play through the role-playing games. Like that was my genre, like the Fallouts and stuff like that. Yeah. Anything with character development.
Same.
I would want to play it again and try a completely different character build.
Yeah.
You know, and I could do that multiple times.
Right.
So, yeah, there are certainly games out there that you're going to get your money's worth without doubt. But even when I was doing that, I did the same thing I did with board games, is I'd buy just about anything that came out. And a lot of those games got 2, maybe 3 hours of play. And I'm like, eh, I'm done. Even if I sold them back used, it still cost me $35, maybe $40 or more in that used amount that I'm going to lose. That's $10 to $20 an hour that I'm losing, you know, that I'm paying for a game like that.
But that's the same with board games. There's no way that you're playing all of these games as often as you play Pyramid Arcade.
Nope. Every one of these games, I would say that I'm probably spending $25 an hour on average when I buy it. I hope to have something that's more in the $5 an hour. I figure that's a completely legitimate... That's the cost of going to a movie in Chicago is like $15. So, and that's about 2 hours.
Yeah.
So if I can get better than a movie, if you're not eating anything, right? If I can get better than a movie prices, then it's worth buying that game.
Yeah.
So I just need to be able to play a game maybe four times, I would say, is my break-even point. So that's why I'm trying to slow down on buying games and play more games.
Yeah, that's a good idea, yeah, because you have a ton.
Yeah.
But yeah. I think it's that when you were talking about role-playing games, like, I like the act of discovery. And I know there are some board games that have that element in somewhat, but these huge, like Skyrim, these huge sandbox
open
role-playing.
World.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And where you can do different storyline paths, like choose your own adventure. You know, that's another rebuttal to Steve's thing about it's one step above watching TV. Like, actually, I do think the modern day RPGs have tons of decisions that make, you know, irreversible changes. Sure, there's some flexibility there, but, you know, you can join different guilds and, yeah, completely change the storyline. And, you know, you can go into someone's house and find some book that has the lore of the universe that you're in. Like, I love that act of just discovering something that feels like I've come across this by accident.
Yeah. So I would say one other thing I do want to touch on before we finish this up is we kind of touched on it, but the social aspect of it, when this weekend, Claudia, our friend Sylvia, Andre, Otelia, they were all here. This is Josh's family and basically my family as well. And we couldn't have found a video game where we could sit down and the eight of us play.
Yeah.
Like, there's just really no game like that. In the GoldenEye days, four people played at a time and then you'd swap around.
That's true.
Dance Dance Revolution, we used to, like, you know, pair up and a bunch of people would watch you play and two people would be playing at a time. Which is fine. Sometimes that's entertaining. Sometimes people don't want to get involved in that, so they would rather spectate. But we were able to find a game that played eight of us with relatively little effort.
Yeah.
Granted, again, I have a game store, but you can have a party game, a couple of different party games, and you can pull those out, right?
Yeah.
And you can play a much bigger group of people in a board game and still have everyone engaged. Four people in a room trying to play the same video game is actually relatively rare.
Yeah.
You know, four people online playing a video game, that's easy, no problem.
Yeah.
So,
but then you lose a bit of that personality,
right,
of you being in the same room.
Yeah.
You can actually, I know that we've talked about the negatives of running into people playing on the internet. You can actually find nice people, though.
Oh, yeah.
There are
that's
good
true.
Players out there. Look at the show, The Guild. I mean, I know that that's fiction, but it comes from a place where these people felt like they were meeting real people on these games, these MMOs in particular.
One of my best friends, he met his wife on playing an MMO.
Wow.
So he and I would go to his room. We played Final Fantasy XI online. We loved this game.
Yeah.
And we would, for an entire, almost year, I just went to his place. We sat in his bedroom and we were playing online in the same room. At the same time, just playing this video game. And he started talking to his wife there. He just happened to be in one of the groups we were killing monsters in. And a year later, a couple visits to Florida, a couple visits to Michigan, I'm flying to Florida to be the best man at their wedding. Wow. A week after facilitating their in-game wedding.
Had an in-game wedding.
Yep,
that's
they had
crazy.
An in-game wedding. And then a week later, we flew down to Florida and they got actually married. And they're still married. This was, almost 12 or 13 years ago now.
Right.
You know,
you can build real relationships in online community.
And you get
on
you,
video
it's
games.
It's a really good avenue to meet people you may never have met. Yeah. And you all share this common interest.
It's true.
It makes it so much easier to do that. Yeah, yeah, that's a good point.
Yep. So, and you can do that with board game meetup groups and things like that too.
Yeah.
We actually have a few requests on doing like game groups and meetup groups. Josh, I think you're probably the most,
the most
outgoing
experience.
And social of us.
I wouldn't have said that. I just meant well, maybe, I don't know.
Well, I like people I know, and if I know them, I will like facilitate playing board games. Yeah. But to go to a meetup or go to a game store and just sit down with random strangers, even all the conventions I go to, I rarely am comfortable sitting down with random people playing.
Right.
And I'm even less so.
Yeah. But I want to cover that topic just to kind of get your feel out of it.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So we will cover this topic.
I've done tons of meetups that aren't board gaming as well. So I do have a feel for what it's like to go to one of these things.
Maybe we should set up a meetup in Chicago.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
I'm starting one, but it's not board game related. Yeah. But yeah.
Well, I'm going to put out a call. I know that we have a number of listeners in Chicago or in the Chicago area.
Oh, yeah.
If you are interested in setting up a time, and we will, like, there's a number of a very game-friendly bars around here that we'll just pick a place and we'll go to and we'll do our own little,
mini meetup. That's a genius idea. We should do that, yeah.
So, and if you email us or, you know, tweet to me or whatever, then I'll know you're interested. Otherwise, at some point, we might just say, hey, we're going to go to this place and we're going to be playing this game. If you're interested, show up and join the game.
I like it.
So maybe we'll do a Burke's Gambit because that would make a great Bard game.
No, trust me. I think you're going to actually like this one. Honestly, yeah. I think you will.
The description you gave earlier, maybe.
Yeah. All right. Well, if you have any extra feedback or input on this topic, please let us know. We're not saying video games are better than board games or board games are better than video games. That was not the intent of this episode. I think we did a pretty good job of highlighting
each's strengths and weaknesses.
Yep. But if you have like a comparison of something that you think one does better than the other, or this is another contrast that we missed, please email us or leave us some feedback on our Board Game Geek podcast page, which you can get to, by the way, by going to tabletopgametalk.com/BGG. And until next week, Josh.
Indeed. Well, thanks for listening. And remember, we love your feedback. So consider leaving us an iTunes review. Email us with your comments or questions at tabletopgametalk@gmail.com and visit us at the site tabletopgametalk.com to learn more about becoming part of the conversation. Finally, a huge thank you to our patrons, Emil Gilljam, Shane Paul, George Thombalai, Jason Strong, Charles Finch, Lucas Hartso, Michael Ohl, Josh Arntz, Trevor Olson, Brian Arnold, Sean Kelly, and all the rest. If you'd like to support us via Patreon, you can find out more at tabletopgametalk.com/Patreon.
Before you go on, that was Tom Bly.
Oh. It's always going to happen, and it'll always be a source of amusement for us all. Until next week, when we talk about the cult of the new. Keep playing games and having fun.
Good night.